Hi, everyone. We are back for another episode of the Helen Science Center's podcast series, Off the Stage. My name is Maddie Miller. I am the media specialist for the Helen Science Center. Today, I am interviewing two people who are here for our 2024 Progressive Conservative Summit. First, we have Caroline Fredrickson, a distinguished visiting professor from practice at Georgetown Law and a senior fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Caroline, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me, Maddie.
And also, we have Ilan Werman, associate professor at the Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law at Arizona State University. Ilan, thank you for being here.
Thank you. So
I would love for you both to just first share where you guys are traveling from today.
I'm traveling from the hotel down the street.
Before
it was
that.
A nice drive. Oh, yesterday,
yes.
I came from Washington.
Oh, cool.
And flew into beautiful Grand Rapids.
So. Yes.
Had a all afternoon to stay inside because it was
too
cold.
I was just going to say, did you see the snowstorm yesterday?
I saw storm might be a bit of an exaggeration
because
I saw snowflakes.
Yeah,
I did not see any snow on the ground, which made me very happy.
Yes.
And I came from Phoenix, Arizona, where it is 50 degrees warmer, possibly 60 degrees warmer than it is here in Grand Rapids.
Extremely jealous. But
sandstorms instead.
Yeah, though surprisingly, we haven't gotten many of those lately, but yes.
That's awesome. Well, cool. Well, I'm glad you guys both made it here safely, and we are very happy to have you guys. For those listening, if you're wondering what the 2024 Progressive Conservative Summit is, that is an event that we host every year on a different topic. So this year's topic is Constitution Reform. So if you are listening, the event will have already happened, but we always record all of our events, so you can watch or listen to that at the link in the description. And I am anticipating a great conversation tonight, so definitely check that out. Like I mentioned before we started this podcast, I'm realizing I forgot our BOQ at our office, but I'm just going to ask you guys some random questions that would normally be in our BOQ. And I actually just asked somebody this on Monday. Do you guys think a hot dog is a sandwich?
This is actually a legal question.
Oh,
isn't it? Didn't Justice Ginsburg famously have an answer? Depending on how you define sandwich, of course,
as
something between two slices of bread, if that's how you define it, she concluded as a result of this, I suppose, statutory interpretation, without a statute, but, you know, interpretation of this rule, that it is a sandwich.
Okay.
That's what she concluded. I don't know what I think.
I hate to say it, Maddie, but I actually don't care very much about whether how it's defined in this case. It doesn't really actually have any impact in the world.
Either
you eat hot dogs or you don't, and you don't care whether it's called a sandwich or not.
That is so
true. I frankly
don't
eat hot dogs, so even though I grew up in Chicago, sorry, Chicago, I left Chicago without missing either the hot dog or the pizza.
Yeah.
But it is a classic question of, you know, indeterminacy in the interpretation of legal rules.
Well, I mean, you know, what is a sandwich after all?
Yeah.
Well, that's the question. So if
is an egg McMuffin a sandwich?
Well, it's kind of like the question, you know, if a statute prohibits vehicles in the park, well, what exactly is a vehicle, right? Is it a tricycle? Is that a vehicle? Is it anything with wheels? So if all of a sudden our benevolent government decided to prohibit sandwiches or to compel the eating of sandwiches, you know, anybody on food stamps can only buy sandwiches. The question becomes, can you
what
buy
is
hot
a
dogs?
Sandwich?
No, okay, this is a bit preposterous, but this is what the professors love to do with their students.
I was
and
just
I'm surprised,
say, you
Caroline,
are
that you're
an
not relishing
at heart.
In this question.
I think illustrating the sort of slippery slope doctrine that conservatives are so prone to, that the government might, and therefore we have all of these things to be worried about, and of course the government is never going to prohibit anybody from eating whatever they want to call a sandwich. You can call whatever you want a sandwich. This is America, right? If you want to call it one piece of bread open face, you know, like avocado
toast.
I was just
going to
say
if you want to call it a sandwich, be my guest.
Okay, but what if a contract between two parties says sandwich, and then there's a dispute over whether the hot dog.
Okay, well, they can define it in their contract.
I can't wait to see, like, a Supreme Court case about this someday down the road.
Well,
as far as I'm concerned, a sandwich is a baguette with a little butter and some jambon, and that's just perfect. Doesn't need anything else.
Great. Of course, the Francophile would define sandwich exactly that way.
So, what more do you need? Yeah.
There were some cases about whether a tomato is a fruit or a vegetable. Contract disputes,
that's
right?
That's true. There were. That is definitely a classic case of statutory interpretation.
And I think they decided that whatever the customary
yes.
practice was.
It's sort of what I'm suggesting. Yeah. Yeah. Right? I mean, though technically we all know, right, that tomato is a fruit.
Exactly.
Right. But let's not split hairs over that.
Exactly.
It is sweet. I don't know if that's what makes it. It has
well,
the seeds.
Right? But do you put it, do you make tomato ice cream? I guess you could. I mean, you can make a tomato sorbet.
Well, I would ask, you know, like you can make apple pie. Do you make tomato pie? Yes. Some
it's
people
called
do.
Pizza.
That's
good. Yeah. Back to pizza.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm so glad I started with this question. This really just, both of your personalities really shined in that. I love it. My last BOQ question for you guys is just to get to know you a little bit more. What is the perfect Saturday for you in your life right now? What would be a
perfect
Saturday?
Saturday. Okay. Get up. Okay. I have to admit that this perfect Saturday would probably take place in the south of France.
Well, I
mentioned I am a Francophile. So I would get up. It would be beautiful, sunny. It would be warm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Love you, Michigan. And I did grow up in Chicago, so I know this, but, you know, I'm yeah. thinking Michigan in the summer, right?
Okay. Yeah.
Get up. It's a beautiful day. I get a nice big cup of coffee. I go for a run. I feel great. I'm fast, right? I'm really fast, like I was when I was in high school, okay? I come back, take a shower, and I go to the market.
Okay.
Go to the market. I mean, not like, you know, Safeway. I'm talking about an open-air market, vegetables and
farmers,
cheeses.
Yeah.
And I buy beautiful tomatoes and some nice bread and cheese and maybe some pâté. And yeah, and then I have lunch. And then I'll sleep the rest of the day.
Oh, okay.
Well, actually, I don't. I can't nap, but I'll lie in the sun.
Yeah, love it.
Well, restricting my Saturday to Arizona rather than the south of France or somewhere more exotic, I think it would also involve a very large cup of coffee and probably reading a book of my choice that has nothing to do with a particular law review article that I'm writing or book that I'm writing or class that I'm teaching, because there's always so much out there to read. And especially as, you know, we get older and have our other responsibilities.
About where the wild things are. Wouldn't that be what you'd be reading now?
No.
Harold and the Purple Crayon?
I have a child, but I'm assuming for the purposes of this Saturday that this child does not commit me to anything in particular.
But the child's sleeping late today.
Exactly. Well, you know, so let's say this is at, you know, 6 in the morning on this beautiful Saturday. And then, yes, I would just be reading something with a nice cup of coffee and not worrying about all the other stuff I have to do.
I love it. Those both sound like great Saturdays.
Will you join me in with my baguette and cheese?
In the south of France?
Yeah.
Yes, especially if it's all paid for.
Okay,
yeah,
who's financing
this trip?
We'll have to figure that one out, but for sure.
Okay.
Is France interested in constitutional reform at all? I mean, we could bring this show about constitutional amendments and the American system.
They have a very different system, and they are amending their constitution right now, actually.
Wow.
To protect a woman's right to have an abortion. They're adding it into their constitution, which would be the first constitution in the world that will include that.
Yeah.
We're deviating from your question, but their amendment process is much less stringent than ours, and they have amended their constitution more frequently. And one of the amendments that we've worked on together, one of the ideas that Ilan and I have worked on together, is that our constitution should be somewhat easier to amend because it is too hard.
Yeah, that's true.
So basically,
been amended in a while.
You're suggesting we could go on a fact-finding mission to France.
We could go on a fact-finding mission.
Yeah, it's a work trip.
It's a work trip. And it's the 200th anniversary of Lafayette's farewell tour of the United States. So we can also go and visit Lafayette's house, which is quite beautiful.
I thought you would suggest it's only fair that Caroline, that you and I go on a tour of France.
We're doing our fact-finding, right? To see what is
in
their...
The whole trip will be an homage to Lafayette.
Yes.
Or how do we say in English? Homage,
I guess.
Yeah. Homage. Well, he's using the French.
Okay.
I love it. This is great. I'm glad you guys just planned your trip together. Excited to see what comes of that. Okay, so my next question is, I would love to hear from just both of you. Tell me where you grew up, what you were interested in as a child, and how in school as well, and how that kind of informed what you went to school for, what your first kind of jobs were, and stuff like that.
Well, I'll start this one. I don't remember exactly all the details of my childhood. It's all a bit vague. Yeah. And I will say that in terms of my ultimate career path, so I grew up in California. Okay, I grew up in Palo Alto, where I know Caroline also spent some time, I believe, because she'll probably explain, her parents were professors there. At Stanford, my dad was in tech, so that's what brought him and my mom to the Silicon Valley. But I'm sort of a case of what the economists call revealed preferences as opposed to stated preferences. Mm-hmm. So some people just kind of know in advance what their preferences are, and they could state it and then take actions, in furtherance of those stated preferences. I'm more of a case of revealed preferences. I reveal my preferences through the actions that I take. And so what did I do? Not in college, but, in law school, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. But then I started writing law review articles. I wrote my first law review article as a third-year student or second-year student at Stanford. And it was published as a student note. And it was really fun. It was like solving this legal puzzle, if you will. And I guess I had rewinding a bit, I was a physics major in undergrad, and just before anyone jumps up and says, oh, that's so impressive, if I'd been any good at it, I would be a physicist. Okay, so like the rest of us, I ended up going to law school, the last refuge of I guess us failed scientists or whatever. But one thing that I do remember about physics is I always loved solving problems. When you find a solution, an elegant solution to a particular physics or math problem, it is like a really enjoyable experience. Well, it turns out law is the same. Law has a lot of puzzles, contradictions, paradoxes, problems. And sometimes you can solve them in the same way that you can solve a physics problem. And so I think my first article here, the student note, was about applying a doctrine that I learned in First Amendment law to a set of Fourth Amendment cases that didn't make any sense. And it was like a key that unlocked all of the cases and made sense of all of the cases. And it was really fun. It was solving a puzzle. Yeah. And before you knew it, I was writing a few more articles after that. And finally, my friends and mentors said, Elon, why don't you get paid to do this? Yeah. And I said, all right, let's give it a shot. And that's how I ended up at Arizona State.
That's awesome. I love hearing that, especially encouragement from other people. That's always important. Caroline?
Well, I guess I've followed a much less direct path, I think, to being a law professor than Alon. I love to travel. Okay, that's obviously true, right? Okay, so I grew up outside of Chicago. I grew up in Evanston. My parents taught at Northwestern then. So most of my formative growing up years were there. Evanston's a great town. It's actually a lot like Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. It's a college town. It's great public schools. It was a great place to grow up, although a little cold in the winter now for me as I've gotten weak living on the East Coast. I went to college thinking I'd be a French major. I'm half French. Mm-hmm. My mother taught French. And I had visited France a few times and really loved it, and I thought that would be a fun thing to study. But somehow my parents were going to spend that year in Russia, in Moscow, when it was the big bad old Soviet Union, and my father was a visiting professor at Moscow State University. And they said, well, why don't you come over at the end of the year, over the summer while we're still there? And I thought, all right, well, maybe I'll study a little Russian. So, well, you don't study a little Russian. If you're going to try and learn any Russian, you have to study a lot of Russian. if you start in college and you're trying to learn and catch up. So I sort of jumped all the way in, because once you start taking those classes, they displace everything else you could take. So I became a Russian studies major. A lot of great things happened out of that. I met my husband over, I have to say, a bottle of vodka at a Russian restaurant in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, where we had organized a trip of students back in the day when we were of age to have vodka while we were in college. I don't advise it. Drink with moderation. Or not at all. So we studied Russian and East European studies. And when I graduated, it seemed like there was no reason to pursue that anymore, because the Soviet Union collapsed and it seemed like everything was perfect and, there would be democracy in the world forever. And yet, of course, we know now that I should have stuck with my Russian, perhaps, or not. I should have studied Ukrainian, so it could be of some help there. But But my passion had always been politics, mm-hmm. American politics. And, somehow my father knew this before I did. I don't know. This was hidden preferences or something. Father knows best. He'd given me a book about Congress when I was 10 years old or something. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what is this about? And I ended up working on the Hill. I worked on a presidential campaign, on a Senate campaign. And then I went to law school and I did practice law for a couple of years. And I thought, you know what? I like that stuff on the Hill more than litigation. And so I went back to the Hill. I spent 10 years working in the Senate. I worked for Senator Tom Daschle as his deputy chief of staff. He was the Democratic leader. And I was chief of staff to Maria Cantwell from Washington State. And then I left to become an advocate on the outside. I worked with the ACLU and I ran a group called the American Constitution Society for 10 and a half years.
That's awesome.
Then finally, I had been writing a lot too. And nobody had been paying me for it. Not really. I've written several books and I was writing a lot of other articles. And then I just thought, at a certain point in your life, and I'm a lot older than both of you, it's nice to have a chance to sort of step back and be somewhat more theoretical and analytical than you might be when you're. And I've always been sort of in the middle of sort of advocacy and political engagement, and to step back and sort of think deeper about issues. And I have to say, it's been a tremendous experience. I've gotten to know Alon, which has been great. Mm-hmm. And I've learned a lot. More deeply engaging with the material is a real opportunity.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's cool to hear. That ties great into my next question. You mentioned that you've written several books. And when I was looking at your bio, one of your books is called Under the Bus, How Working Women Are Being Run Over. So I'm 25, fairly new in my career as a working woman. So I'm curious what is something that you found in writing this book that you think I should know?
Well, I mean, there are a number of things that were, even for me, I practiced labor law. Mm-hmm. And then I did employment and labor issues for Senator Daschle, as well as judiciary issues when I first worked for him. I had a fairly good background, I thought. I wrote my law review note on a case of employment discrimination involving mm-hmm. Section 1981. I'd taken employment discrimination in law school, and I thought I had a fairly good understanding of the law, but I really didn't understand the historical reason for certain exceptions in the law. That mm-hmm. is, who is left out and why. And when you look at that, it's really an important instruction in American history, because a lot of our most formative labor and employment laws were written in the 30s. They were adopted under the presidency of Franklin Roosevelt, and we're very progressive at the time, meant to mm-hmm. enable working people to join unions and bargain collectively and ensure fair wages, minimum wage and overtime payment and so forth. But there are really significant exceptions for certain groups for agricultural workers and mm-hmm. for domestic workers. It's only when you understand the politics of the time that you know why. It's because mm-hmm. that was really what was still present on the plantation economies in the South, and in order to get the votes of the Dixiecrats, of the Southern Democrats, for Roosevelt's package of reforms, he needed to make concessions, and that was to exclude what were primarily their black workforce in the South from coverage. And there were a lot of other areas. There were fights over Social Security. There were fights over other exemptions that you will still see, like, why are taxi drivers not covered by the National Labor Relations Act? Mm-hmm. That's why can't they join a union, et cetera. So there's some really interesting things. I looked a lot at kind of different models of fair pay. Mm-hmm. Women make, as I think most people know, about 80 cents on the dollar for what men make. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of reasons, and I think we've talked a lot in public and in the media about, teacher pay. Mm-hmm. Teacher pay is very low. Nursing pay is very low.
Yep.
There are areas that have historically been dominated by women. And yet, if an economist would analyze the inputs, that is, how much education you need, what are the training, the skills, mm-hmm. The importance to the workforce, the productivity, mm-hmm. whatever, you'd find these are professions that actually should be much better paid than they are. And there's only really one explanation, was that the fact that they are women dominated is what keeps the wages lower. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of areas that I look at, as well as the so-called gig economy and contracting, and why that has particularly negative impact on women, because there are a lot of sectors, again, that are treated as contracting as opposed to real employment. And therefore exempt from all of the important benefits. And so it was really eye-opening for me to write. I think there's so much more that we need to do in this area. And childcare, huge gaping hole in the American safety net, which is that people with children are not helped, except very minimally, by tax credits and things like that. Rather than having affordable childcare.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I could talk about that for so long, because my sister is really going through that. She is a nurse and now has two kids, and trying to balance like childcare. Like, they can't afford daycare, but so is it worth like her staying home, or, you know, that whole balance? Mm-hmm. So they're always working through that.
Right. And that staying home then has an impact on your pay.
Exactly.
And then, you know, and the thing that I think people don't often think about is it has a real impact on women in their later life.
Yeah.
Because all of those years spent out of the workforce mean a much lower contribution into either pension, but certainly into Social Security.
Yeah.
And women live longer. Mm-hmm. And so older women in poverty is a real problem.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you for sharing that insight. I'll link the link to your book in the description of this episode if anyone is interested in checking it out. But speaking of books, we will turn to your book, which is called The Second Founding, An Introduction to the 14th Amendment. I just realized I said your book, and I'm, for those listening, I'm talking to Elon here. So I'm asking this for myself and honestly anyone else who is listening who is not maybe as familiar with the Constitution and its amendments. So in your own words, what is the 14th Amendment about, and why is it important enough to write an entire book about?
Sure. Well, the 14th Amendment is probably the most important amendment in terms of constitutional litigation today. I will say there's a section of the 14th Amendment that makes it particularly important that today that everyone has been talking about, Section 3, which prohibits people who have taken an oath to the Constitution as prior office holders and who shall have engaged insurrection against the United States from holding office in the future. And so there is obviously a question as to whether former President Trump is covered by that, and other people who had run for office and were present at the Capitol on January 6th are disqualified under Section 3. My book has absolutely nothing to do with Section 3. And in fact, until, I don't know, a few months ago, everybody thought Section 3 was irrelevant. Is that fair to say? So my book is called The Second Founding. It came out around the same time as Eric Foner, who's a historian. His book, also called The Second Founding, a different subtitle. And he's far more famous than I am. But he, I think, said in that book something to the effect that Section 3 is totally irrelevant now, or it's totally obsolete. So, of course, we spoke too soon. But my book is not about that at all, right? So until a few months ago, anyway, and probably still today, the most important provision is Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. And it is the clause of the Constitution. It's actually a set of clauses. It grants birthright citizenship. So there was this question before the Civil War whether a free black persons in the United States, right? So they were not enslaved. Were they citizens of the United States within the meaning of the Constitution, such that they're entitled to various privileges and immunities that the Constitution gives to citizens? And this had a lot of implications. The Dred Scott case infamously involved this question. And this settles it. This settles it. You know, declares all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, so not ambassadors, kids, and so on, are hereby declared to be citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. And then it has certain restrictions on the states. The original Constitution had very few restrictions on the states themselves. It had restrictions on the national government, the federal government. And there were some restrictions on the states as well. If you look at Article 1, Section 10, you know, there are some things about, like, no state shall impair the obligations of contract, okay? So, and so there were some restrictions, but principally not. The Bill of Rights did not apply to the states. Well, the 14th Amendment changed all that, right? The 14th Amendment has a set of clauses. It says, no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. So there's a question as to what exactly that means. And more familiarly, I would say it has a due process clause, an equal protection clause, right? No state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, or deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Well, due process of law and equal protection of the laws are the two clauses that basically drive constitutional litigation today. All the race discrimination cases, the gerrymandering cases that are equal protection cases, you know, equal rights for women cases are equal protection cases. Due process cases, give us, you know, abortion rights are all about that. Same-sex marriage rights, you know, all of those are due process questions under this doctrine called substantive due process, which I will not unpack here for your readers. It's a bit complicated. And the 14th Amendment is what is believed and treated as having made the Bill of Rights, which was originally only applicable to the federal government, applicable against the states too. So now when you say, oh, this, you know, California can't violate my First Amendment rights, or Michigan can't violate my Fourth Amendment rights, actually what you're saying is that this, that Michigan or California has violated the 14th Amendment, right? And through that has violated the First or Fourth Amendment, which has been incorporated through the theory being either due process or the privileges or immunities clause. I've actually, my book expresses skepticism about whether that was correct.
Okay.
And so I go very much against the conventional wisdom. For a long time, the conventional wisdom that incorporation of the Bill of Rights, you know, making the Bill of Rights applicable to the states was not what the framers intended. And then since the 80s, basically the conventional wisdom has been that is what they intended. And I'm actually not sure that that's right. But what I basically argue in the book is it was primarily about equality, which I don't think anybody disputes that it was largely about equality. But I try to show that all of that stuff that people say about the Bill of Rights, really, it was just about equality more than anything. Anyway, it gets much more complicated than that, but but that's what that book is about, and it is only 145 pages, and only $20 or something. You know, so its greatest virtues.
Yes. Awesome.
Its greatest virtues are its slim,
it's slim, it's cheap, and has a really pretty cover. So I like to say those are its three greatest virtues. And then I like to say
it also has the
virtue of being correct, but more people disagree with me about that than the other three.
Yeah, okay. So you're finding common ground with the cover and the cost and all that. Awesome. Well, that will also be linked in the description below if you're interested in checking out either of their books. So we kind of chatted about this earlier, but you guys were both team leads on opposite teams for the National Constitution Center's Constitution Drafting Project. So first, can one of you explain a little bit what that project was for our listeners?
I'll take a crack at that. So the National Constitution Center, based in Philadelphia, a federally chartered corporation, is an institution that is designed for civic education about the Constitution and constitutional values. So they thought, and Jeff Rosen, who's the president there, thought it would be a good idea to have a project that involved sort of imagining new versions of the Constitution. What would they look like from different points of view? And so he reached out to three of us initially, I think, that to have teams of scholars, three on each team, to construct a new version of the Constitution. So there was a progressive team, which I led, the conservative team, which Ilan led, although they had a few troubles along the way in constructing their team. Conservatives are obviously have too many commitments. So, and there's a conservative, a libertarian team. And so we all set out to sort of draft our versions of the Constitution We all ended up adhering fairly closely to the original Constitution. I'll get to why the progressive team did that in a minute, but I think for the libertarian team, they like it perfectly fine the way it is. So they were, you know, they were just, they wanted to just put an exclamation point. And then we ended up actually having some areas of overlap, which I think we're going to get to later. But I would say, so the progressive team, the reason why, you know, there are many more modern constitutions. We have a very old constitution. There are a lot of implementation problems. There are a lot of vagueness issues. There are a lot of questions about how it applies to current events and situations that are obviously not anticipated at the time. And so, but despite the fact that we could have looked at, you know, the South African constitution, which people generally think is kind of well-written, or the German constitution, or many other more modern ones, you know, because in part this is a civic education project, we really wanted to use our draft to illuminate some of the major constitutional debates within the United States now, rather than simply saying that's a great model constitution and seeming to be, you know, not so relevant to, you know, what we're actually engaging in. So we wrote a constitution that adhered more or less to the structure, but raising some issues, you know, including protecting the right to vote more overtly, anchoring bodily autonomy overtly, ensuring that there's a robust congressional oversight mechanism, changing impeachment standards, and making it easier to amend the Constitution, among many other areas.
Yeah, that's awesome. Elon, anything to add?
Yeah, I know Caroline said that we would get to this, but I do want to emphasize the overlap, which is partly why we're here today, or largely
please,
why we're here today.
Please talk about that.
Basically, when we looked at these constitutions, we saw some areas of overlap, and the National Constitution Center decided to get the teams together to try to actually have a mini constitutional convention of sorts.
That's awesome.
And we did, and we proposed a set of amendments to the Constitution that all three teams could agree on. Now, to be clear, you know, the voting rule within the convention did not require unanimity. You know, so I think we had 8 participants most of the time, maybe 9. It didn't require unanimity. It required a supermajority and at least one person supporting from each team to make sure that there was, you know, widespread sort of a consensus. And I think this project has a lot of pedagogical value and inspirational value in a way. It shows that you can get people who really disagree about the fundamentals of politics to talk to each other, to like each other, to have civil discourse, and actually come to agree on some things. Yeah. I mean, I don't think anybody thinks that the Constitution is perfect. And so I think most of us came away from that project thinking that, you know, although these proposed amendments, some of which we will presumably speak about tonight's event, I don't think anyone thinks that any of them are perfect, but I think everybody, for the most part, most of us thought that they are better than the particular provisions that they are supplementing or replacing. And so we thought it was a very useful project.
Yeah. Was there any like one particular takeaway that you guys, I mean, I'm sure you learned a lot through this process, but is there like one particular thing that comes to mind when you think about a takeaway from this project?
I think Ilan already kind of identified it, but it was the idea that if you actually talk to each other, you might find some room for agreement.
Yeah.
And I think that was, and I have to really credit Ilan who was one of those who really helped identify the overlaps.
Yeah.
But Ilya Soman, also, who is a professor at George Mason Law School, who wrote a piece, maybe it was in the National Review.
Reason, National Review.
Somewhere, he'd already remarked on some of the areas of agreement. And I think it's easy to pass that sort of moment and not take advantage of it. And so I also give a lot of credit to Jeff Rosen and the National Constitution Center for saying, hey, this is something we should do something with. And having it actually move forward in a way that can illustrate the opportunities for dialogue, discussion, and even agreement.
Yeah, love it. Awesome, well,
let me say one last thing about takeaway.
Yeah.
I don't think neither Caroline nor I would say it was easy, right, to come to agreement. I mean, you also see how far apart you are on some things. But in a way, again, that shouldn't interfere with other things like friendship and dialogue and discourse where we can find a common ground. So I don't think it was easy, but it was absolutely worthwhile.
Let me just say our convention, our mini convention, was 3 days long.
Wow.
It was virtual. But there were some real hard discussions. And Alan is absolutely right. It wasn't easy. I don't want to make it sound like, oh, you just have to start talking to each other and everything gets solved.
Yeah.
But you start hearing each other's arguments and start thinking about how do we actually meet that? Or is it persuasive? Or can we give on something else? I think I just had, so I teach legislation and statutory interpretation, and I had my former boss, Senator Tom Daschle, come to my class this past week, and he talked about that spirit of cooperation, conciliation, and tolerance that he really valued with his time in the Senate, and sort of how much less of that there is now. Some of his closest friends continue to be his Republican colleagues from the Senate when he was there. And I think, you know, I think hopefully we can model something of that. It wasn't as if Senator Daschle and Senator Lott, who was his sort of counterpart across the aisle for many years, had a lot of agreement on substance, but they really could work together. When they needed to figure out how to run the Senate, you know, that was their job and they did it.
And let me just reemphasize that, because I really didn't talk about that at all, but that's absolutely right. It's not just that we can get together and find out that we agree about a bunch of things. Sometimes you do have to give. You have to decide, okay, this issue is more important to them than it is to us, and so we're willing to give it up. So it's not like we agree about things. It's we do agree about some things. But at the end of the day, the whole purpose of a compromise package, whether in Congress or an amendment, is that we all agree it's better than what exists now, even if it's not the best thing that we have. And so we have to give things up. We have to, you know, an obvious example of this, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, is judicial reform. You know, there's the question of term limits, and there's a question of fixing the justices at a certain number. And again, there wasn't unanimity on this question, but it's obvious that, you know, conservatives prefer one thing, you know, fixing the justices at 9 to avoid court packing. Progressives really care about term limits. And then it's okay. The question is, which of these do you care more about? And are you willing to compromise in the middle? And again, it's not perfect. And it wasn't, you know, unanimous on that or other provisions necessarily. But again, sometimes you have to give. It's not just you'll decide you all agree about things.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that really actually flows into another question I had written, which is, you guys are obviously here for our Progressive Conservative Summit representing different viewpoints, which is like how, you know, we approach different conversations in with our Common Ground Initiative. You guys have mentioned Common Ground many times. And with this being in an election year, it's especially important to have civil discourse and to be talking about that stuff. I was just curious how you guys navigate this in your own life. How do you navigate like sticking to your own beliefs and advocating for your point of view, but also wanting to hear others and find common ground? How do you guys balance that?
Well, you know, I think it's a great question, especially for those of us in academia.
Yeah.
Because, you know, nobody comes from nowhere, right? Everybody has a background and a point of view. And as a professor, you have that. And your students know what that is. They know what you've written. They know where, you know, what you've engaged with. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel like I should try and hide that, but I have to be really open. I have to make sure that no student feels excluded, that no student feels somehow unheard, that their point of view is not respected. And so I think that is such a value of academia that we need to, you know, I'd like to see that brought out more into the rest of the world, because it's a really, you know, speaking of pedagogy, you cannot be a good professor. That's sort of everything else is less important in some ways, you know, your substantive knowledge, if you don't have that value of recognizing that everybody has a valid right to speak, that they, you know, you can argue with them, you can give them counter arguments. But you need to be respectful. You need to create an environment of learning and openness to different points of view. And so I think I've had a long career in politics, and the years I spent in the Senate, there were major disagreements. There was definitely lots of areas where the Democrats and the Republicans were not going to ever even reach the any compromise. Mm-hmm. But there were a lot of areas where they did. And there were a lot of, as Senator Daschle was talking about, some of his closest friends were Republicans. And I was a staffer. We worked across the aisle all the time on different projects. And I just think it's something that I would love to see more in sort of the way we engage with each other now. But mm-hmm. the one thing I can try and do is make sure that happens in my classroom.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Yeah, I'll just echo that. As law professors, we really don't have a choice.
Yeah.
I think that Caroline and I both try to embody that.
Yeah, that's great. So we have time for one more question. It's the question I always end this podcast with. So I'd love to hear from both of you. What is advice that you would give to somebody wanting to have a similar career path as you? So you guys are both kind of in law and whatnot. What advice would you give?
So I'll start. The advice I would give is... it's really two-way advice. One is to professors and educators. Don't assign too much reading. Okay? But the corollary advice here to students is read, but read well. Mm. Read slowly. Read for understanding. And, of course, a lot of this is on is the responsibility of your professors. Like, if they assign hundreds of pages of readings and multiple books, like, you're not going to retain it all. Yeah. And I think reading is important. Gathering knowledge is important. Mm-hmm. But that requires patience. It requires reading slowly. It requires reading for understanding. And quite mm-hmm. frankly, it requires understanding that when you're young, you really don't know very much. And if you're lucky, you will have that realization early on. Mm-hmm. If you're like me, mid to late 20s is when you'll realize that, wait, I thought I knew everything when I was 18. Turns out I didn't. Mm-hmm. I barely knew anything. Yeah. And that's the breakthrough. And I would just hope that student, everybody, academics as well, older mm-hmm. professionals, but students especially, have some humility to realize that there's so much knowledge out there. There's so much to learn out there. And you have just begun this voyage, and you're just scratch the surface of this sort of profound depth of human knowledge. And so just treat the whole project with humility.
I love that.
I love the way you framed the question initially, which was, I think, law and whatnot. So yes. Ilan is more law, and yep. I'm law and whatnot, yep. in part because my career has been so much mm-hmm. less unidirectional.
Yeah.
And with that, I have enough students come and talk to me and say, I'm really interested in how, in your career and how'd you get there? And I think, well, it makes sense when I look backwards. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have anticipated this necessarily looking forward. It makes total sense now. But I think the advice that I would give, which is very much, and, I agree with everything Ilan has to say, but to add, one other piece, which is not only should you recognize that there is so much more to know, but that you should also think about what it is you want to know particularly and what it is you want to try and pursue. Mm-hmm. I think the only way to be successful is to do something you feel like you want to do. Mm-hmm. And that trying to do something because it's the right career mm-hmm. step, because someone else tells you so, because it seems like the better item on your resume, but it's not really what you want to do, is not the right thing. Because it's only when you feel passionate about your pursuits that I think you can be mm-hmm. really successful. And that could be anything, right? Yeah. I mean, you could be passionate about any number of things, or you could be passionate about things that aren't your job, but are, mm-hmm. are your hobbies. You might be great at... a great weaver, or make really nice sweaters. And by the way, I'd love one because I love sweaters. But
I thought you were going to say because it's cold.
And because it's cold, right? I really love sweaters. But so for me, I think that's I really think it's important that people mm-hmm. follow their dreams to the extent that they can. Mm-hmm. That if they have the possibility of following their dreams, I think it leads to better career moves.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great to hear. Thank you both for sharing that. We have a lot of students who listen to the podcast, so that's great advice for them. Thanks for being here today. We are excited for your conversation tonight. And Ilan and Caroline will be on stage with Jeffrey Rosen tonight. And like I mentioned earlier, for those of you who are listening, we will have a link in the description to you can listen to the event in podcast form or watch the YouTube video and check that out. And thank you guys so much for being here today.
Thanks, Maddie.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.